Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. And today on the podcast, we are interviewing the one and only iconic Dr. Jean Carruthers. Jean is a globally recognized pioneer in cosmetic surgery and non-invasive procedures with unparalleled expertise in research and clinical practice. Together with her husband, Dr. Alistair Carruthers, she revolutionized the cosmetic industry and basically helped to bring botulinum toxin to life and to practices around the world and to millions, 100 million treatments and millions of patients. Botox has since then become the most widely performed cosmetic procedure worldwide, and her insights have been featured in all kinds of scientific publications, but even publications like Vogue, Time, and Newsweek, New York Times. She's truly a thought leader, and she has authored over 300 peer-reviewed scientific publications, 70 book chapters, wow, and 9 textbooks. And she is the foremost authority in her field on botulinum toxins. She is really, truly groundbreaking. I'm so honored to have you on the podcast today. And she's also a clinical professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, where she continues to inspire me and the next generation of physicians. So, welcome to the podcast, Jean,
Thank
Dr.
you so much.
Carruthers.
Thank you. Oh, please call me Jean.
I would love to know what it's been like to come up in this field that's always science and medicine are male dominated. And at the time, 25 years ago, or around that time, that you helped develop with Alistair the entire scientific use and clinical application of this very potent toxin. How was it as a woman in science at that time?
Well, I think a great way to describe it is that everybody thought I was crazy.
Really?
Why don't you go back to being a pediatric ophthalmologist? You were so good. Why don't you just drop that terrible poison? But you know, once you've realized it's only a terrible poison when it's out of control, that you actually can control it with the dosage that you give and the place that you deliver it. You then realize this is, should be standard of care for all the dystonias instead of surgery. For the people who, I had so many patients who would come in unable to open their eyes, unable to drive a car, earn a living, cross the street, and 3 days later they're driving their red convertible and back being productive members of society. Once you see that, you can't go back. Because once you've seen what it can do for those conditions, then of course the medical mind reaches out and thinks, what else can it do? And I think one of the things, and this was something I talked about in my TED talk a few years ago, that most doctors at that time were very much medical and very against cosmetic. This is something that's frivolous. It's just not worth our time. And yet, here is something that can solve a whole lot of cosmetic issues with very little downtime and with great patient effectiveness. So why is it that you are crazy? And it took a long time for people to suddenly start realizing, oh yes, it isn't such a poison, and to stop thinking of it totally as a poison and that we were crazy, but to start thinking about, oh, it's a drug and it's a wonderful new drug. So we must have gone through about, I suppose, 8 or 10 years of being thought crazy. So it's kind of a relief to come out the other side.
That's always the case when a genius has an idea explode. Everyone first thinks that they're crazy, right? And you initially used Botox, of course, for pediatric patients having strabismus or the crooked eye correction. Was it a big leap to transfer then that thinking over towards facial wrinkles and rhytids?
It was a leap to go from extraocular muscles, where you need a special giving apparatus because the motor end plate is way back. You don't see where you're injecting, you hear it because you're using an EMG machine. So you get the muscle to recruit, you hear the roar, that's the spot. But it was a big leap to go from that to benign essential blepharospasm, where there are plentiful end plates all over the face and neck. And that was truly, truly a magnificent leap, because from that came the cosmetic.
Interesting. And how do you think your initial approach to neurotoxin has evolved since those early cosmetic days to today? And any big changes that you've seen in patient expectations or provider use?
Oh, I think there's been enormous changes. Provider expectations are it is always going to work. And the patients also believe it is always going to work. This is something that is unusual for any drug. So very high expectations that are again and again fully met. So I think it's one of those relaxing things that this is a new treatment, but it's a treatment that actually works. So that's one thing. But I do feel also that there is an expectation that more is coming with this molecule, because so much has come already. What else can you do with this? And I think that's where we are right now. We've reached a lot of people from the cosmetic point of view, but I think we're dealing with a new generation now. The baby boomers, and God bless them, and particularly the first 18 patients who trusted us with our first study. I mean, what a leap of faith. But our baby boomer generation tend to treat things after they've occurred. Whereas the millennials, I think, are smarter than us. And they could see what might happen, and let's prevent it. So I think that's what we're starting to see now with the millennials, and to some extent with Generation Z, where people are saying, well, if I did this sooner, maybe I wouldn't get to that particular state.
So interesting. I think I totally agree with you. I think even our techniques are evolving to be a little bit more of a global approach versus spot treatment areas and maybe slightly lighter dosing, not necessarily always, using the same dose for every patient. It's very much become very customized, I guess, is the best way to say it. We are now seeing Botox being used for microtox dosing all over the full face, like for skin quality and improvements in pore size and various things like even depression. These psychological studies that show that when you can't move the frown muscles or you alleviate the fr ability to frown, you also alleviate the depression. I think, what do you think of that?
I think it's brilliant. The first person to describe that was actually a dermatologic surgeon called Eric Finzi, out of Washington. And he studied nine women, and he used depression scales. And he found that 30 units only of Botox in the glabella, 9 out of 10 women were remarkably better from the point of view of their depression. And many other excellent researchers have followed on from this approach. I think it's an interesting you ask that question, because I think that's probably the next huge area for the neuromodulators is in wellness. We mentioned treating depression, but what about treating social anxiety disorders? What about treating self-esteem disorders? These are all things that fit into wellness. And I think it's an important whole new world that medical doctors can actually help with mood, not just with sending a patient for psychotherapy.
Interesting. Well, how would we treat for, social anxiety disorders or, well, anxiety in general? I really do think it would help with anxiety.
Yeah, I think maybe we need a lot of it in the world.
We do
Well,
to microdose
exactly.
everybody in their Starbucks, but would it be certain muscle groups you think that are tensed up when you are anxious, and thus it's like a snowball effect that your muscles are tense, so you start to feel tense, then you're worried about being tense, then you're all of a sudden very, very anxious.
Yeah, you're so right. The facial feedback hypothesis is an important one. But it's really interesting. It's way back in 1967, some psychiatrists actually did muscle recordings from the corrugator. I was very impressed. And they called it the muscle of anxiety. And actually, before them, Charles Darwin in 1862 came up with the omega sign. You know, when you see somebody frown and they get this upswing here, and that is his omega sign, and that's an absolute sign of depression. And
interesting.
So I think that those are the muscles that you treat to treat anxiety of any kind and depression, negative mood. And the thing that was really, really amazing is back in, I think, 2006, some researchers in Padua in Italy injected the rat whisker area and then discovered the neuromodulator at the back of the brain. And so that shocked everybody because really, it's going into the brain? I thought it stayed in the skin. And I think that's what's happening with the mood changes, is that it's going into the amygdala, which is at the anterior inferior end of our temporal gyrus. And you can show with functional MRI, which records the amount of oxygen being used by the amygdala. So you show somebody a picture of somebody who's fearful or anxious or angry, and that activates their amygdala. You can show the increased oxygen uptake on the functional MRI. And then 2 weeks later, after you've injected the Botox in that area, in the frown area, you redo the functional MRI and there's no response by the amygdala. Wow.
That's incredible. And you mentioned that we are just in kindergarten with this molecule. And it's true. We are in the first 20 years of, you know, like, for example, man going to the moon. It's the very, very beginning of this journey. And in some ways, we're all part of the test generation. Are there some concerns we should have with this concept that perhaps, you know, it can pass the brain barrier and it does adjust things at a molecular level that we haven't yet picked up?
Well, I think it's always a
concern. We've had so many treatments already and people are doing quite well.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's interesting to look at diffusion tensor imaging, which is a neurological test. There's a Dr. Ann Blood at Harvard who's shown that by diffusion tensor imaging, that people who have blepharospasm normalize their results when they have treatment of their dystonia with Botox. So I think it's a good thing. I think it's just a surprise that that's how it was working. Besides superficially on the muscles, also working inside. What to be scared of? I think to be scared of people who don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, there have been a number of, I'm going to call them poisonings, where somebody has sourced neuromodulator that is not FDA or Health Canada or other governmental body approved, and have injected, for example, in 2004, an unfrocked osteopathic physician injected 2.5 million units into each of four people, one of whom was himself.
Oh, gosh.
And the lucky thing is that they were in a community that had a very good ICU, or none of them would have survived. So that's what scares me, is that people who don't know what they're doing, they look at a vial and they see milligrams and they don't know the difference between a milligram and a unit, because it's
horrific.
Horrific.
It really is. And it's so readily available that on the black market and being sold online. And I get emails all the time from people who are not vendors that are reputable or accredited or is government approved, and it's out there. So the consumer needs to really be aware, actually.
I totally agree.
Yeah. What do you think of having the consumer see now in America, 5, 6 different big brands of toxin available? In the rest of the world, there's hundreds of brands. I'm sure you travel and lecture internationally. How does the consumer stay on top of being educated about each brand and its qualities and its characteristics?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect question. I think they need to be aware of the doctors in their area who are doing the treatment, who are, you know, like yourself, fully accredited physicians who have had the appropriate training. You can find out who it is if you don't know, looking at websites from the various provider companies or from academic groupings like the derm surgeons and the plastic surgeons. I think those are important things. But you know where it really matters is talking to your friends and your family, because often they've been through the same questioning process and have come up with some recommendations that work for them and are safe.
I think so. I think people should not treat it like a spa manicure treatment. They need to really ask a lot of questions from their physician and their family and their peer group, and take some time, go do a deep dive on the provider that you're going to be seeing. Because honestly, yes, there can be spread, there can be wrong dosage, wrong muscle injections, all kinds of issues. But in general, it's been so very safe. It's been, like you said, a miracle drug. What are some of the fabulous uses that people may not have heard of all over the body that are, that were thrilling when you heard of them?
Okay, well, I'll start with a weird one on the face. Sometimes when people smile, even though they weigh only 110 pounds, they say it makes me look fat when they smile across the candle at dinner. A couple of units just into the pretarsal orbicularis of both lower lids widen your eyes when you smile. Or sometimes people get that little tiny bit older and notice their nasal tip is dripping downwards. And so a little injection here into the depressor septi can lift the tip of your nose. I think a lot of middle-aged women don't know about overactive bladder, because there's a condition in middle-aged women where they have this urge to urinate without actually needing to. And so that Botox can be injected into the bladder itself in order to stop it overreacting. And I think that you can, sh the thing that's really interesting too is you can shrink glands. So, in the from the sweat point of view, in the axillae or on the face with Frye's syndrome, you can actually stop people sweating, and it lasts for a really nice long time.
I have some ladies who come and do their scalp so that when they work out, they don't ruin their whole blowout every single exercise class. So there are people who have become creative with it. Toxin is also used now for intradermal usage, like treating rosacea. Do you think that the mechanism is limited to just inhibiting those cholinergic transmissions in the dermis, or is there maybe another vascular effect going on?
I think there's a vascular effect as well, because if you inject somebody and then 2 weeks later ask them to run up and down the stairs a couple of times and then come back, the places where you've injected, there's a white area around those.
Really?
Yeah, so there's obviously it's affecting the precapillary sphincters in those areas.
That's interesting. Is that part of the testing in the studies that
No.
you're doing that they're running up and down, or they just notice
Oh, no, I didn't actually notice that myself. It was one of my nurses who I was injecting, and
that?
she said, "You know, when I run up the stairs, I get these white dots on my forehead." And I looked at the treatment plan, and yes, that's exactly where I had injected her. But I agree with you that using it for complexion in tiny, tiny doses, I think was really pioneered by plastic surgeon Dr. Waffles Wu in Singapore. And he uses it all the time on patients' face and neck to the great benefit of their appearance. It's skillfully done like he does it. It's a great treatment. Unskillfully done, where the needles go in a little too deep in the cheeks, you can actually drop the face. It looks like a facial palsy. So it's to the It's looking to the skill of the ejector.
Interesting. I definitely use that for microtox treatment, like all over the full face. It gives quite a nice, pretty smoothening and a glow. And some people think it helps with melanocytes, like stopping their migration and pigmentation. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it does. I think there's it's not well studied, but I do think in one study I did with the IPL and all I did was crow's feet injection, 30 units, 15 on each side, plus a series of IPLs. And there was a 15% reduction in pigment. So
Interesting.
I think that there's more to be discovered. See, we're still really, we not may not even be in kindergarten.
I know we're still in preschool, maybe. I know that even some men are using this for penile, enlargement, allowing things to hang longer, and very creative and interesting uses from shrinking calf muscles to improving voice quality for laryngospasm. That's my personal favorite because it's such a teeny tiny muscle and it makes such a huge difference in people's lives when they can speak a little bit better. Are there any exciting things that excites you most about where this technology is headed in the next few years?
I
You
think there,
mentioned mood, but besides the mood.
yeah, besides mood, there are. It's one of the interesting things that most of the glands in our body work by using snare proteins. So there may be a way that botulinum toxin molecules can be modified to make use of that to help people who have other glandular problems. So I think that's one area that is being researched at the moment.
Yeah, that should be very interesting. You wonder too if they can use it in areas where there's like vasospasm issues. Like, who knows if someday that'll be a treatment for arterial vasospasm, in critical arteries of the heart or other kind of sphincter muscles and things like that. It's not already being used. Are there any common misconceptions or misuses of Botox that you'd love to correct people's thinking on for this today's younger generation?
Well, I think sometimes there's a confusion. Sometimes people think that Botox fills in the wrinkles. No, that actually is that the Botox is actually working, yes, on the skin and yes, on the muscle underneath the skin, but not by filling. It's actually having an effect on the sweat glands and on the oil glands and on the muscle. And it's filler that actually is often used with the neuromodulator, with the Botox, or which of the approved ones that are available, which is giving the support, the physical support to the wrinkles so that it gives a nice smooth contour to the patient's cheek.
The toxins all have such different sensations. Having personally tried many of them, I'm kind of aware of certain toxins feeling lighter or more frozen or more tight, some of them more smoothening. Do you think that that's related to exogenous proteins, peptides, or any thoughts on differences despite them all having comparable clinical efficacy?
I think the active portion in all of them is the same, the 150 kilodaltons. I know that a lot of my patients who want to have, they have high foreheads with many horizontal forehead lines. They actually like Xeomin on their foreheads. It's really interesting. And some of the German researchers have found that they get more diffusion with Dysport. Than they do with, say, Botox. Then, of course, there's the high-dose studies that we've looked at. And I think that's really interesting that there are one of our colleagues in California says that we've been treating people with Botox like it was beer, where we should have been treating them like it was with scotch. In other words, his feeling is that we've been underdosing everybody. And it's really true if you take the high dose studies and supposing and you apply it to your own practice, supposing you've got a patient who travels and they're not going to be back for 7, 8 months, you might want to reduce the dilution of the dose that you're giving them, and that will make it last longer.
Yeah, interesting. Do you think there'll be on-label indications for all of that soon? For higher dose, longer duration.
When you see how much money it costs to get an indication, I think that that's probably not going to happen for a little while. You're looking at hundreds of millions of dollars to get an FDA indication. It's such a valuable thing. So I would imagine it's something that will happen over the next, say, decade, but I can't see it being something that'll happen right now.
It's interesting that you talked about patient expectations that this is a molecule and a medicine that will always work, but we're starting to see patients who have kind of toxin resistance or immunogenicity issues. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and what toxin has a higher potential to create that or a lower potential? And is it the host organism that's the problem or what's going on there?
Great questions. First of all, it's rare. It's extremely rare. In a lot of th prospective randomized studies, we're looking at about a half of 1%. And then that is compounded by the fact that there is some individual characteristics in the HLA markers. For people who do get the immunogenicity, people whose families come from the Eastern Mediterranean, Southern Asia, and also the Aborigines have HLA markers that are seen with people who tend to get the immunogenicity.
Interesting. Wow, you mean Southern Asia, like Indian, like myself, or different parts of Asia? I need to be curious here.
I know of two patients from Russia, and I know of people from Iran and from Syria. So sort of Eastern Mediterranean and east of that. And then presumably the Aborigine thing relates to the fact that all those land masses were once together.
Interesting. You and your team recently authored an article on immunogenicity to toxins for the glabellar lines, and that showed Xeomin having the lowest risk of getting antibodies, Dysport is the highest, and then brand name Botox was kind of right in the middle. And it kind of talked about frequency versus dosage. What was kind of the take-home message? Is it how frequent you're getting your toxin or the number of total units? What should we get from that?
No question that it's much more common if you're getting huge doses. For example, the people who have overactive bladder probably get 400 units for their bladder. And if they happen to also have dystonia of the face and neck, they might get another 400 units from a different provider. See where I'm going with this. So if you've got a patient who is seeing a number of different providers, they may actually be getting, as much as, say, 800 or 1,000 units. And that's actually something that starts to be more of an issue, is the high doses. And obviously, you can immunize people. There are stories out there of physicians who've just given somebody 3 or 4 units, and we'll see you back in 2 weeks. And then they give them another 3 or 4 units, and so on. And what you're essentially doing is immunizing them. So basically, I usually see people back in 10 days, 2 weeks. If they need a unit or two here or there to even things out, so be it. But I don't give another big dose again. I think it's important that we leave them for a good 3, 4 months in between.
Yeah, very true. So if a provider brings people back or the patients that are asking for a little thing is starting to move here and starting to move there, they're actually doing themselves a disservice, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think that you have to wait until you have, enough moving again so you can give them another dose. Yeah.
And if you do have a patient who's developed some resistance, would you recommend just doing a toxin holiday for a 6 month period, like a washout period, or just switching between toxins?
Well, that's an interesting question because there is a homology. A lot of people do this and say, oh, well, I think you're immune. We've done four different kinds of A on you, and you haven't responded to any of them. So we'll try B. And B has a 30, the has a 30% homology with A, the proteins, the complexing proteins. So then pretty soon you get a resistance to B as well. So I communicated with one of the world's experts on this, Dr. Joe Jankovic, who is the lead author on a number of publications on this. And he feels that a holiday of 30 months is
30 months. Wow. That's a
the
long
way to
holiday.
go. That's a long holiday. And I think that's probably right. I've done that with one of my patients. And then she persuaded me after about 9 months that it would she'd like to try it again, and she got quite a reaction. You don't
Wow.
expect a reaction at all, but she did. So now, yes, we're on a 30-month holiday now.
Wow. Okay. So we're really waiting for, your body's own antibody sensing capacity to wane, antigen
It does
sensing.
do that. Like rubella, your immunity to rubella does wane.
Yeah.
This is so sad because there's such intelligent, caring, beautiful people and can't have it. Is sort of the mainstay for everybody else. It's a problem.
Well, are you following the new treatments such as polynucleotides and exosomes that we're hearing so much about in aesthetic medicine? Are there any things that people can do in the interim using some of these new technologies, perhaps?
Now, I think that the thing with exosomes I've never quite got over is that there are so many exosomes made from so many different sources by so many different methods.
Yes.
A bit like chicken soup. Some of them have DNA and RNA in them. And so I've gone the route of working with a company out of Toronto. I think they also have offices in Los Angeles, where you actually pluck 50 hairs out of the back of the patient's head, and they get air freighted to the lab in Toronto, and they make your own secretosomes. So you made it. It's your product. And then we microneedle that into people's faces for wrinkles and into the scalp for hair loss. And it's
That's
about
wonderful.
twice as effective as PRP.
That's with Acorn, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. And they're extremely wonderful. It's just a little expensive and it takes a little time, but it's definitely autologous is the best. As you said, there's such a lot of technology hitting the market. What kind of things do you look for scientifically when you evaluate these new kind of bioactive injectables? Because there's a lot of marketing claims being stated out there.
Well, you might say the marketing is ahead of the science. And the science is what I look at. Where are these sourced from? And what is the methodology? And where are the peer review scientific articles that show benefit and comparisons and risks? So I can't sort of use it on these things on my patients until I see that there actually is good science behind them.
Interesting. And what do you think about the biostimulators and the surge and using things like PLLA and CAHA and things that help to produce, they're becoming kind of cornerstones of facial rejuvenation procedures. How do you think they compare to traditional fillers?
Well, the only frustrating thing about them is that you can't take them out. With hyaluronic acid fillers, you can use hyaluronidase and you can remove them. That is such a wonderful thing. The CAHA fillers, you want to be going to somebody who's very experienced, because if the product isn't sort of mixed properly, it's very easy to get lumps. And I've had all sorts of people say that they were injected with in the lower eyelid region. It's like a pop truck emptied out there. And I think it's fine under the thicker skin, along the jawline, the cheeks. I think in the neck, But I think around the eyes, probably there are other things that are better.
Yes, for sure. I think that you've, come up in an area, as we said, where there's so many men doing the scientific research. Do you think that there is balanced research related to how these drugs and products are interacting in women's physiology and women's skin and women's muscles and plates? Has the research been very balanced in terms of gender?
The research is not balanced at all because most of the patients in the research, 80-90% are women. And most of the researchers in the research are 80-90% men.
Exactly.
You contrast this to cardiovascular research, where there is balance because 90% of the researchers are men and 90% of the patients are men. So, it's a different world. At least most of the patients in the aesthetic space are women. So I think that we're well studied. I think what we don't have is really great information on more men.
Actually, that's true. Maybe they need to fight for themselves a little bit more than men to get representation. But you've mentored so many physicians over the years. What advice do you give to young women entering the aesthetic space? Because
Oh,
honestly, you're a role model to so many of us.
thank you so much. Well, I think that you don't enter this space unless you really are interested in how people feel. So I think to be empathetic, to listen to your patients, to understand where it is that they're coming from, I think that has to be number one. It's not a field that's top down. If you're going to have your gallbladder removed, you might have a discussion with your surgeon about where the scar will be placed or if it's going to be endoscopic. But in the aesthetic world, what the patient wants is something you have to absolutely understand. And so to me, it's one thing listening to the patient, and I also take great photographs every single visit. And I stand in front of the photographs on a screen with the patient because I used to hand people a mirror and I never really knew what they were looking at. You know, it's transparent. We're both looking at the same things. And because of the technology, we can go back in time and see and compare to today. So they can make their own minds up. But I think that would be my major advice is listen to your patient.
I love that. Is there one piece of advice you wish someone had given you as you started early in your career?
Well,
Maybe
I think that
ask
really
for more shares in the company. That would be one.
yeah, I think believe in yourself. Believe in yourself. You know, there is the world in our world is medical world is male dominated. And I do feel that as a woman, you have to have more self-esteem and more dedication in order to be a really successful person. And I think to do that, it's very helpful to find a really excellent female mentor.
It is helpful. It does. You need someone who's been down the road before you to show you where all the hurdles are and how to succeed, Are you able to discuss, tell us what you're going to be doing in the next 5 years, like your plan? And are you still in practice? Will you stay in practice?
Yeah, I'm still in practice. I love my patients. I love my office. My office manager actually is my youngest son.
Oh, amazing.
He's very techie, but he loves people. So the patients adore him. And it's fun. It's just he has a great sense of humor. So we have wonderful days. And I'm still doing research. I'm still publishing. I'm still lecturing around the world. So it's a glorious life. And the thing that what am I doing every single day in order to keep doing this? I'm living what I speak of. I'm doing the wellness thing. I'm exercising like a mad fiend every day. I watch what I eat. I think about wellness and how it applies to my patients. And I try and do the same thing to myself.
That's wonderful. Is there any supplements you're taking that you recommend? I always ask everyone what their favorite biohacks are, and it sounds like you're doing a lot of them.
Well, I think you can't beat vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an excellent daily thing. I discovered that when I was a pediatric ophthalmologist and I had three young sons, and I would come home from the office with a cold I'd caught from the office, and I would go back to the office with a cold I'd caught from my son. And God bless Linus Pauling, because I think a gram a day of vitamin C is a wonderful thing. I also like to use niacinamide and coenzyme Q10 and vitamin D3. I think we need to make sure our bones are doing good things as well. But I think the other thing which I'm much more conscious of nowadays, being a lot older than everybody else on the planet, is protein.
Yes.
We should all be eating at least 20 grams of protein within half an hour of exercising every day. And we should probably, if you read Dr. Peter Attia, he recommends a gram of protein per pound of your weight. In my case, I should be eating 115 grams of protein a day. Well, I have a
lot. That's a
friend.
lot.
I have a friend who's a bodybuilder, and I asked her how much she eats, and she said, "Oh, 500 grams." I said, "Oh my God,
wow.
how do you do that?
Wow.
That's amazing." And she said, "Two turkey breasts." Well, that would be totally beyond me.
Yeah, maybe some protein drinks and a protein bar here and there, and then two, at least one turkey breast. Well, it's been an absolute joy chatting with you, and I can't wait to someday meet you in person, and hope to meet you at an aesthetic meeting coming soon. You mentioned a couple of meetings that you're going to be at. Where will you be lecturing?
I'm at the Harvard meeting. I think it's September 28th. And then at the American Society for Derm Surgery, which is November 14th to 16th in Chicago.
Wonderful. And I have to go back and listen to your TED Talk. I didn't realize you had a TED Talk, so I'm going to look that up.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, its main claim to fame, honestly, was I wanted to talk about what we had done. And the advisors said, well, why don't you talk about how the success in the cosmetic world meant that other physicians who are treating other things could then say, oh, I could use that in my area. So I think that was another thing the cosmetic has done for people who are treating different conditions.
Yeah, it's so exciting. I'm sure we'll see more developments coming soon in terms of improvements in scars with using Botox and definitely rosacea treatments. And I love the mood idea. I can't wait to see how that will manifest, because I think it's honestly true that the facial feedback muscles do contribute to mood overall.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Jean, Dr. Carruthers, thank you for your time today. And where can people find you? You mentioned you had an Instagram profile. What's your handle?
At Carruthers Cosmetic.
Okay, perfect. And do you have a website we can also look at?
Yes, it's CarruthersCosmetic.com.
Amazing. That's it for now, guys. I hope that you have learned so much from one of the original icons and pioneers of botulinum toxin, who's brought this molecule into pretty much all of our lives. I don't know anyone who has not been touched by either, you know, someone who's doing it, or you've done it yourself. And the future is bright for the advances that are coming for all the uses of the toxin molecule when it's, as you said, when it's used in a controlled way and not as a poison. So that's it for now, guys. Don't forget to find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, DRKAY, doing amazing things with people's faces. And our website is the same. It's beautybydrk.com. And I hope that you all understand everything there is to know about Botox and ask all the great questions. Send Dr. Carruthers a DM. She's very interactive and like so cutting edge in her thinking. Truly inspired. Thank you so much and have a beautiful week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Love you guys. Stay beautiful.